Each year, the Unitarian Universalist Association chooses one book as a UU common read that it encourages all UUs to read, to discuss, and to consider acting differently in light of the contents. Previous common reads in recent years have included The Death of Jocelyn, Immigration Stories from the Arizona-Mexico Borderlands. That was chosen for the year that General Assembly was in Phoenix. We almost considered boycotting because of the tent city jails and the injustice and the inhumane conditions there, but decided to go anyway and to make it a Justice General Assembly where we would go in protest and use our presence there to call attention to the heinous conditions. Another is Act of Faith, the story of an American Muslim, the struggle for the soul of a generation. That was by Eboo Patel, and actually he's the one who founded the Interfaith Youth Corps that Laura was talking about earlier. Another that we read here together is The New Jim Crow, Mass Incarceration in an Age of Colorblindness by Michelle Alexander. And last year's was Behind the Kitchen Door, talking about justice for restaurant workers. If you haven't read any of those, I would encourage any or I would recommend any or all of them to you. And if any of them particularly piqued your interest, also consider the ways that you might engage in activism. There's different ways in which we here at UUCF have engaged in activism around each of those issues in recent years. This year's UUA Common Read is called Reclaiming Prophetic Witness, Liberal Religion in the Public Square. It's by a UU minister named Paul Rezor, who is currently the director of the Center for the Study of Religious Freedom at Virginia Wesleyan College. I should perhaps add that if you're intrigued by that title, Reclaiming Prophetic Witness, Liberal Religion in the Public Square, the good news is the book is quite short, weighing in at just around 100 pages. It's very light, small. It's almost just like a pamphlet, you know, like it's good. The major goal of his book is to challenge UUs and other religious progressives to reflect on the ways that our values do or could support our activism in creating a more just, equitable, and peaceful world. And when I think about that title, that first part of the title, Reclaiming Prophetic Witness, what first comes to mind for me is the biblical tradition of the Hebrew prophets that Mary referred to earlier. And when I think about them, I guess first I think about the ways that the more theologically conservative congregation of my childhood taught me to view the Hebrew prophets in a very different way than what Rezor has in mind. They taught me to read what they called the Old Testament, right? That really kind of gives it away from the beginning, right? This is the Old Testament. We should call it the Vintage Testament, right? The Elder Testament. I don't know. The First Testament. But they taught me to read the Old Testament very selectively for the ways these books and passages in them could be read as predicting events centuries into the future in the life of Jesus. But in college, when I took a class on the Hebrew prophets and began reading those books from the perspective of their original context, I began to see that it's clear that most of the biblical prophets were principally concerned not about the distant future, but about their present. And really, any predictions they made were really about, like, if you go into this war, this is what will happen. If you don't change this law, they were concerned about predicting things in their present, not about centuries into the future. They were concerned with social injustice and corruption in their own day. And that they would be perplexed and shocked, I came to see, if they could have somehow been transported in time and become aware of how Christians would read their texts centuries later. As the Jewish literary critic Harold Bloom has said regarding the ways that Christians have often read Jewish scriptures, he said, "It's like Christians stole our watch and for the last 2,000 years have been trying to tell us what time it is." There's a lot more to say about the interpretation of the Hebrew Bible. I'll eventually teach a class here at UUCF on the Hebrew prophets, but for now, let me give you just two pivotal examples that were highly influential on 20th century social prophets like Rabbi Abraham Joshua Heschel and the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. The first of the two is from the fifth chapter of the prophet Amos. He's speaking on behalf of the divine, and Amos says to the people, I despise your festivals. This is bad news for the Spring into Action picnic, right? No, so I hate your festivals. I take no delight in your solemn assemblies. That's bad news for our worship practice. He says, even though you offer me burnt offerings and grain offerings, I will not accept them, and the offering of well-being of your fatted animals, I will not look upon. You're going to all this trouble, you're burning your best animals, and I don't care. Take away from me the noise of your songs. So your songs are quite lovely, but that's not what Amos thinks we want. I will not listen to the melody of your harps. So think how this prophetic indictment would have sounded to the religious leaders of Amos's day, or really of today, or any day. And he says, instead of all this stuff that you think is what is needed, he says, no, let justice roll down like waters, and righteousness like an ever-flowing stream. What I care about is justice and righteousness, how you act, how you behave, how you treat each other. A second example is from the sixth chapter of the prophet Micah and has been called the Psalm of the Prophets. So later, for those of you who are familiar with the Christian tradition, we're going to get this interlocutor coming to Jesus and saying, Jesus, what is the greatest commandment? And so traditionally, the Jewish tradition came to see itself as having 613 mitzvot, 613 commandments. And so they said, Jesus, which is the greatest? And he said, well, the greatest is to love God with your whole heart, soul, mind, and strength. And that's, of course, he's not just making that up. He's quoting Deuteronomy 6:5, right? So of these 613 commandments, he says the greatest is Deuteronomy 6:5. And the second is like it, to love your neighbor as yourself, right? And what Jesus is quoting there is Leviticus. Of all the things in Leviticus, right? It's really interesting that what he picks out to talk about is the part where it says, love your neighbor as yourself. So that basically all things aren't created equal in the Torah, that loving God and loving your neighbor is more important. And so, but before Jesus ever came along, people used to look to this verse in Micah as the sum of the prophets. And it says from Micah 6, shall I come before God with burnt offerings, with calves a year old? Will God be pleased with thousands of rams? If I'm rich enough to give God thousands of rams and 10,000 rivers of oil, shall I give my firstborn for my transgression? So that's a whole separate sermon where we can talk about, right, the sacrifice of Isaac, the sacrifice of Jesus for the firstborn, right? There's a whole, Canaanites used to sacrifice firstborn, so there is a whole tradition of that. Shall I give my firstborn for my transgression, the fruit of my body for the sin of my soul? There's also the whole firstborn of the Egyptians dying, right, in Exodus. But he says, no, none of that. God has told you, O mortal, what is good and what is required of you. And it's not any of that. What is required of you is to do justice, to love kindness, and to walk humbly with your God, what you understand to be sacred or divine. To do justice, to love kindness, and to walk humbly. The biblical prophets felt that God wanted the world to be less corrupt and more just, more peaceful, more equitable, and they lived out of this sacred calling in some actually very startling, disturbing, and intimidating ways, doing things like marrying a prostitute to make a point, walking around naked, yelling at people, though there were also both central and peripheral prophets. The peripheral prophets were more like the John the Baptizer wandering in the wilderness, proclaiming the day of the Lord, and eating locusts and honey. And there were also central prophets like Isaiah, who sort of had the king's ear. So there was a spectrum of prophetic witness. But as Mary sort of said about translating this to the 21st century, we don't live in Israel during the 8th century BCE. We instead live in the West in the 21st century, on the other side of the scientific revolution, on the other side of Copernicus and Darwin and Einstein and Hubble and many others. So what might it mean to reclaim prophetic witness today in light of all that we know in the 21st century? What are our sacred values that can inspire us and sustain the hard work of a lifetime lived for working for peace and justice? To pick up and extend the work of the prophets who have gone before us and on whose shoulders we stand. The late American pragmatist philosopher Richard Rorty has written compellingly about what it might look like to see ourselves as part of a long line of prophetic witnesses. Limiting our focus for now to only the past few centuries in the U.S., Rorty writes about the possibility of increasing numbers of people acquiring an image of ourselves as heirs to a tradition of increasing liberty and of rising hope. Of wanting ourselves and our children to come to think of ourselves as proud and loyal citizens of a country that slowly and painfully freed ourselves threw off a foreign yoke, freed our slaves, enfranchised our women, restrained our robber barons, and licensed our trade unions, liberalized our religious practices, broadened our moral tolerance, and built colleges in which increasing numbers of the population could participate. A country that numbered Jefferson and Thoreau, Susan B. Anthony, Eugene Debs, Rosa Parks, and James Baldwin among its citizens. Along these lines, Ray Zohr is inviting us to take a step back and reflect on what are the core sacred values that motivated our forebears to commit to the long-term work of social change, and in the hope that explicitly naming these sacred values might ennoble, enliven, and embolden us to, in Dr. King's words, build the beloved community. For Zohr, such sacred values are what he calls liberal religious values. And you can consider if that terminology works for you or not. And before I proceed much further, allow me to pause briefly and directly address the confusion that can arise from that term, liberal religion, in the public square. He does not mean, for example, that being a UU necessitates being a Democrat, even any more than being a Christian necessitates being a Republican. Instead, it is very much possible and has often been the case historically that one can be a theological, a religious liberal, and a political conservative, or vice versa. To think of just the most prominent example that comes to mind off the top of my head, think of William Howard Taft, right? He was, during World War I, was president of the Unitarian National Conference, but he was not a Democratic president. He was a Republican president, right? And later Supreme Court justice. Or you can think about during the 19th century. Sure, we had people like Theodore Parker that were, you know, partnering with John Brown and were sort of radicals for social progressivism and emancipating slaves, but like Channing was more like in the center, and then you certainly had many Unitarian ministers who were kind of for the status quo and didn't want to risk anything. And there are ways in which, you know, it's no coincidence that the UU headquarters used to be at 25 Beacon Street, right beside the governor's mansion. We were right there at the seat of power, and many people were liberal theologically, but conservative economically, conservative politically, and thought that that was the best thing for the country. So just as we seek to be a liberal religious tradition in the best sense of that word liberal, so liberal comes from the Latin root liber, meaning free. And so when we say we're a liberal religious tradition, we mean liberal in the best sense of that word. Generous, open to new ideas, open-handed, open-hearted, open-minded. But there has also been room historically, and there must be room today within our big tent of Unitarian Universalism for those who are conservative in the best sense of the word, caring about the conservation of nature, upholding the beauty of tradition and rituals that have accrued deep meaning through the test of time, reminding us of the importance not only of individual rights and equality, which is what liberals do really well, but also reminding us what conservatives do better, about reminding us that it's not just about individuals, it's also about community, and that authority can actually have power when done well. Sanctity, loyalty. This dynamic is one reason that many religious progressives resonate deeply with contemporary, in some ways conservative, prophets like Wendell Berry, who are conservative in the best sense of the word. We desperately need such voices in progressive religious communities. But in contrast to this big tent position, conventional wisdom today too often wrongly holds that all religious people are political, social, and economic conservatives, overemphasizing the religious right and ignoring the tremendous historic influence of what could be called the religious left, from women's suffrage to civil rights and more. Surveying our landscape today, Ray Zohr highlights that two theologies dominate the U.S. cultural experience, two conservative theologies. One, the theology of redemptive violence, that insists that bad violence can only be met by good violence. Right? And the theology of free market fundamentalism. And I think you saying that it's a theology is not incorrect. Like, people sort of hold on to these things. This is religious values, core sacred values. So a free market fundamentalism, which insists that the free market creates order and balance. And one major challenge of Zohr's book is to consider what alternative convictions religious progressives might bring to the public square. As a starting point, Resor offers the following list of, for your consideration, of core theological principles of religious liberals, who may or may not be political liberals. So he says, and here they are, the fundamental unity and interdependence of all existence, that we are not ultimately separate, but we are interdependent and deeply influence one another. That we believe in the transforming power of love, that love can change us. And that's what MLK meant by the beloved community, that the beloved community was that community that was created when people who used to see themselves as enemies were transformed through love to see themselves as part of a greater whole. The inherent worth and dignity of all persons. Human freedom. Now, that's kind of comes as contrast to our Calvinist forebears, right, who used to say, no, we're predestined. So he says, no, we believe in human freedom. And that we reject moral dualism. We reject any sharp separation between good and evil, refusing to assign individuals and nations to one category or the other, knowing that that too often leads to seeing ourselves as wholly good and the other as wholly bad, instead of saying that there is good and evil with both of us. Belief in social justice enable us to all live with dignity and respect. Cooperative power that we believe not in coercion, but in persuasion. We persuade, not coerce. We believe in religious freedom, and we believe in theological openness. To give just a few examples of what the practical implications of this perspective could be, in a review of recent resolutions passed by the UUA at the annual General Assemblies, Razor notes that most read like political policy platforms rather than statements of religious conviction. Fewer than 20% mentioned Unitarian Universalist core principles, and then only in passing an introductory sort of whereas clauses. Let's get those out of the way and then get to the real things we care about, the policy. Or all policy wonks. But if we introduced our religious convictions, our core sacred values into the equation, what might that look like? I'll give you just three examples. How might our environmental justice work to curb climate change be more sustainable if it emerged out of a deep, felt, existential sense of the interdependent web of all existence? Not just theoretically, but really feeling yourself connected to that web of everyone else, including this planet. Likewise, how might our work to defend against threats to voting rights be stronger if it emerged out of the religious, seeing our fifth principle as a religious conviction, the right of conscience, that we fundamentally, sacredly believe that everyone's conscience must be respected, and the use of the democratic process within our congregations and society at large as a way of respecting that conscience? And how might our work for immigration justice or against torture be inspired through a greater awareness of our first principle, the inherent worth and dignity, not just of some people, but of all human beings? And to see that that is drawn from the first line of the preamble to the 1948 United Nations Declaration of Human Rights, Universal Declaration of Human Rights, which recognizes, quote, the inherent dignity and the equal and inalienable rights of all members of the human family, and that is the foundation for freedom, justice, and peace in the world. That if we're ever going to have freedom, justice, and peace in the world, the Universal Declaration of Human Rights is saying, if you want those things, it starts with recognizing that every human being has inherent worth and dignity. Likewise, the very first sentence of Article 1 of the UN's Universal Declaration of Human Rights says, quote, all human beings are born free and equal in dignity and rights. For me, it's incredibly powerful, hopeful, and significant to be part of a religious movement that explicitly chose to weave into our first principle the starting point as the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. Those are the sorts of sentiments that Razor is trying to tap into when he talks about reclaiming prophetic witness, liberal religion in the public square. And with all of this being said, allow me to qualify as well and to be clear that by no means am I trying to undermine the First Amendment's protection against the establishment of religion. At the same time, the First Amendment also prohibits interference with the free exercise of religion. And regarding the intersection of religion and state, perhaps Dr. King said it best in his book, The Strength to Love. He said that the church must be reminded that it is not the master or the servant of the state, but rather the conscience of the state. It must be the guide and the critic of the state, but never its tool. And if the church does not recapture its prophetic zeal, it will become an irrelevant social club without moral or spiritual authority. Now, there's so much more to say about all of this. And again, if you have time or interest, I invite you. We'll take about a 15-minute break after worship and then regather for anyone who wants to continue the conversation. For now, I'll leave you with these words from the Forward to Resource book that reminds us of the many different forms of prophetic witness needed in our world today. In times like these, prophets must speak loudly, clearly, and with many voices. We need prophets of economics to explain the cascading consequences of inequality and envision workplace democracy and socially responsible investment. We need prophets of science who can track the steady increases of global temperature, chart its implications, and convey the urgency of those implications to policymakers. We need prophets of the arts to express their vision for social renewal in stirring songs and inspiring stories. We need prophets who testify to the human costs of inequality and oppression and tell their stories of how individuals and communities can and have fought back. And we need prophets of faith to bring the rich resources of religion into the struggle, making ancient religions new by applying them to today's challenges. The question then turns back on each of us to look inside ourselves, around at the world around us with those whom we have connections to, and ask, how do I feel called to speak or to act prophetically in my sphere of influence? What are your spheres of influence, and where might you feel called to speak or act prophetically within them? There's a lot of other stories I could tell you about that Hebrew prophets class that I took in college, and it was really kind of a turning point for me. I'll only tell you one for now. There was a point when we were talking about kind of contemporary prophetic figures, and I was raised Southern Baptist, and our professor was Baptist as well. And I remember him, though he was quite liberal, he had gone to Princeton and actually was a co-writer of one of the Hebrew translation textbook that they use there, but he was asking sort of examples in different people of, would you say this person is a contemporary prophet? And when he came to me, he just happened to name Billy Graham. And I was like, I'm not sure. And he's like, whoa, you really are rethinking some things. I mean, sort of Billy Graham is kind of, high and lifted up in the Southern Baptist tradition. But then, and I'll say more about this in a future sermon, but it's really, he's actually a particularly interesting case to look at. Like when he went and visited with Truman was very uncomfortable with public prayer. Partially that was because of the Bible, and Truman knew in the Bible it said don't pray in public like the Pharisees. But then you get to Eisenhower, and Eisenhower sort of very publicly said yes, on his inauguration day. He's like, he told everybody in his cabinet, either come to church with me at St. John's Episcopal or go to church somewhere. So it's really interesting to see how thinking in relationship to those peripheral and central prophets in the, in the 8th century BCE, to then look at how, Billy Graham and other people sort of have had presidents' ears, and how presidents are and aren't being affected by religion, and how it's so easy to turn from being the conscience of the state to being the tool of the state and being just used to legitimize policy. So it's interesting things to continue to reflect on through today. But as you continue your journey, continue it walking in love. Care for one another and care for this one earth. Do justice and make peace. And as you go, know that whatever taste or touch of hope, of love, of peace, or joy that you've experienced in this time and place, that goes with you out into the world. So live boldly and with thanksgiving. Go in peace.